Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, it seems we have a problem. I would like to introduce...
Welcome to another edition of the Bigfoot's Pad Paranormal Radio. I have Tim with me on the line today, and today's show is going to be a great show. It's going to have Stanton Friedman and Frank Fasciano talking about their work with the Braxton County Monster. What do you think, Tim? Should be a good show?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, well, I'm trying to call Stanton Friedman to join us on the show real quick, and then I'll call our other guest.
Sound good.
All right, should be calling Stanton.
Good evening.
Hey, Stanton.
That's me.
On the line with me today, I have my co-host, Tim, and we're getting ready to call Frank here in a second.
Okay.
All right. So how are you doing today, Stanton?
Oh, been busy. Been busy going down to New Hampshire on Thursday, so got plenty to do.
Oh, wow.
That's for the Betty and Barney Hill, you know, that conference in honor of the 61st anniversary.
Yeah.
51st anniversary, sorry.
I'm going to call Frank here real quick.
Okay.
Hello.
Hey, Frank.
Hey, we all ready, man?
Yep, on the line with me, I have Stanton Friedman's on the line, and I have my friend Tim.
Okay.
And we're ready to go.
Did you get the emails I sent within the past hour?
No, but I can go check it right now, though.
Yeah,
I did.
Hey, how you doing? There's a couple emails there that might be useful to you.
All righty, I'll go open them right now.
Okay, very good. Hey, Stan, how are you?
Keeping busy, Frank. Keeping busy.
Yeah.
Getting old, but keeping busy.
Hey, you're not getting older, Stanton, are you?
Well, yeah, it seems to work that way. I don't know how to turn it around, but I've still got my record. Never spent overnight in a hospital, so.
There you go.
It's a good record to have.
How'd the show go the other night, Stan?
Very well.
Good, good.
Yeah.
This is going to be a historic show tonight. Stan, you believe it's 10 years already since we were up there for the anniversary with Peggy Kleiss and everybody?
I was going to ask you, about 10 years? Yeah. Yeah, because
yeah.
It was the 50th anniversary, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then we were up there for the Monster Quest shoot a couple years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
And John Kleiss, Peggy's son, he's really keeping on top of stuff up there, Stan. He does an online newspaper called the Central West Virginian.
Yeah.
And he's blasting this thing out all over. It's the 14th biggest newspaper in the state, and it's the biggest one in the Braxton County Central area. So he's really taking a liking to it. He's kind of picking up where Peggy left off. You know, she passed away about a year and a half ago. So
I didn't know that, but okay.
Yeah, yeah, she passed away. She had a heart attack going in for an operation. And John picked up the ball, and he's been working with me pretty close, and he's getting the word out there, and he's doing anniversary stories and all kinds of stuff. So
good show.
It's going good. Somebody up there is at least keeping it going. And Porterfield, I talked to him. He's going to go up from Beckley when I'm up there to release the book with Larry and Alfred. And
yeah,
he's going to do a feature article and interview us on spot. And remember Johnny Barker, the old-timer who was in his 80s? He's the last known survivor. He's going to go up there with us and set up and talk to the public, too.
Well, good show.
Yeah, so we're getting everybody together. Freddie's not doing too good.
I was going to ask you how he was doing.
Yeah, he's not doing so great, and his wife isn't either. But I talked to Piddle, his wife, last week, and she was excited and said to say hello. She's proud of all of us for carrying this thing on. So it's
good
still
people
moving, Stanton. Yeah, yeah, all of them, they're very good up there. And John said to say hello to you when I talked to him the other day.
Good.
He interviewed me last week, Stan, and
yeah,
he said he didn't, everybody up there knows the story of the monster by now, so he wanted to do an in-depth and personal effect. So what he did is he asked me how I met Colonel Levitt and what happened during the interview and when I met Mrs.
Sure.
May and all the people. So it's a little inside personal thing. So he's going to print that tomorrow. And I'll give you the link to it so you can check it out.
Okay. Good. Good.
Yeah, and then I sent you an article about an hour ago. Alfred and I were working on it. I don't know if you read it yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, the one from that Alfred and I did. He's going to add some pictures to it. And he's going to blast that out on the internet tomorrow.
That's great. Well, so, it's good that there's some sensible people involved in these things, you know. I'm waiting for Joe Nickel to jump in here, you know.
Well,
I
think
we're
going to
say, we have some questions coming in for the interview, you guys.
Anytime.
I don't know how you guys want to do this. I was going to say, because I wrote down some questions. I've not had a direct them at any specific one of you guys.
Well, give it a shot, and we'll see.
All right, well, I was going to say, for our listeners, I was going to say, does Frank and Stanton want to talk a little bit about how each of them got involved with the story or how you guys decided to meet up and do the book?
Well,
we could start
Frank
that,
did
yeah
the book. It's Frank's book now. But,
yeah,
we got started pretty innocently. Frank approached me if I wanted to go to the 50th anniversary celebration. And I said, well, let me do some checking first. I'd heard of the story, but I didn't know what to think about it, really. It wasn't my primary focus. So I did a lot of digging, and I said, yeah, I'd like to get involved. And then I was lucky enough to have a chance over the years. I met with Frank. And we were up there on site at the 50th anniversary. We met a few other times. And I was able to help in a few ways anyway, getting help from people I know to dig out clippings from that era. And we turned up that strange story of Shoot Them Down, which wasn't in the New York Times or the Washington Post, would you believe, but was in the Louisville Courier and a number of other papers. And that made the story even more strange, especially when it was General Ramey, the same guy involved with Roswell five years earlier, who was the one who said that they'd scrambled jets hundreds of times, just routine. So, and also, I was able to help a bit with, I've been to 20 archives, and I did some archival research trying to get stories about some of the crashed airplanes. And, boy, that was pulling teeth, because a lot of that stuff just isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
We talk, and I've tried to help out in any way I can. And, Roswell's my beat with a lot of other cases, but this one intrigues me partly because of the expected idiocy of the explanations from the nasty, noisy negativists. I mean, they're consistent. If the first solution doesn't work, try a second. If that doesn't work, try a third. And any ABA, anything but alien, you know. I love 6 foot owls. I mean, they're pretty remarkable. They should be in every zoo in the country.
Well, how did you get involved originally, Frank?
I have relatives who live up in Braxton County and originally lived up in the Frametown area. And I was up there visiting a little over 20 years ago. And I originally was working with Colin Andrews when Colin lived in England, because I was photographing and documenting crop circle rings that were appearing throughout the Braxton County area. When I started going up there the first few times, it was real intriguing at speaking to the locals who lived up in the mountains in Frametown and Flatwoods, the Sutton area, which is basically the central geographical point of the state. And they were talking about seeing UFOs and flying saucers, you know, a pretty common thing up there. And that really shocked me. And from that point, working with Colin, I gave him all my documentation. I gave him my video footage, snapshot, soil samples, a whole ball of wax. And to make a long story short, I was contacted by his wife about 2 years later. And the same crop circle rings that were appearing in Braxton County were appearing in England as well. Same size, same shape, pattern. So that was kind of shocking and intriguing also. During the first couple of times I was in Braxton County documenting all these rings and UFOs and interviewing the locals about what was going on there, that's when I found out about the Braxton County Monster. So I kind of stumbled onto it. I had no intention of getting involved in this thing. It was just something on the side, and when I would go up for family get-togethers, I would just go up there and talk to the different locals, and I thought it was something pretty cool to start documenting. When I found out about the Flatwoods Monster, or Braxton County Monster, I went into town for the first time with my cousin, and as we pulled into Flatwoods from the south end of town, there's this big gigantic wooden sign on the right-hand side of the road. It says, "Welcome to Flatwoods, home of the Green Monster." I started looking into the story shortly after that. I lived in Connecticut at this point, and I was hitting all major libraries throughout the state. I was going up to Yale University, big libraries in New Haven, Bridgeport, Brantford, and I was looking up stories about the Flatwoods Monster. Then I started going to used bookstores and, you know, different locations, and I started accumulating all of this information about the story. And what was funny about the whole thing is no two stories were alike. I had compiled dozens of stories on this Flatwoods case, and every one I read it told me something different. You know, one story would say Mrs. May and her two kids saw the thing flying over. Another one had 15 kids. Another one was 6 kids. You know, and actually when I started working with Mrs. May, I'll never forget, I sat down, I says, "Kathleen," I says, "look at all of these different articles. You know, what's going on with this? Two kids saw it, 3 kids saw it, 6 kids saw it." And I never forget, she said, "Frank," she says, "how are you going to have a football game with 2 kids?" And I said, "what do you mean?" She said, "well, it was Friday night after, you know, school. Pick up, the kids look forward to the weekend. How are you going to have a big football game with 2 kids?" She said the town was loaded with kids. She says that's what they did for entertainment. There was a ton of kids down at the school playground. There was even some of the little girls sitting on the sideline cheering the kids on. It was a big, big event for a Friday night in a small town community. And I started talking to Kathleen a little bit more in depth and started showing her more articles and more articles. And from that point forward, she started referring me to different people to interview, because it wasn't easy, you know, being from Connecticut, you know, going into the, you know, the backwoods of West Virginia, very clannish and clicky. It's hard to establish to move into that area. with a story that was covered up and people that were ridiculed for so many years, and here I come, you know, storming into the area, asking questions and carrying cameras and doing all sorts of stuff, and it was like, whoa, you know, back off, get out of here. So I wasn't received too well at the very beginning, and it was basically Kathleen who spoke to some of the different locals, and she basically had said, this guy's pretty serious, he's found some great stuff. And a big turning point with my investigation was when I got the Project Blue Book documents. It took me about 5 years to go through these documents because they were faded. By the time they were duplicated and laid around the archives for the Air Force to photograph them, the ink had faded on these documents. So what I got was a lot of washed out documents. So after about 5 years of going through, it was well over 150 pages of documents, I had re-inked them. And my background in illustration and art and calligraphy helped with that. I bought handwriting analyst books. I talked to different people who were experts in handwriting, and we were able to figure out all these documents. There were majority were tentative questionnaires documents. So I re-inked all of this stuff over, and I started showing more of these documents to Kathleen and saying, look at this, look at this, look at that. And where she was really floored was the explanation of this six-foot owl up in the tree. And that's what Stanton was talking about a little bit earlier. So there was a massive cover-up put in place with this whole story. The witnesses I worked with told me a lot of things that were never put into the press, like intelligence officers going up there. Kathleen spoke to Colonel Dale Levitt. He was a World War II hero who came back to Braxton County, and he was the commander of the West Virginia National Guard. I spoke to Levitt on several occasions, and one occasion I actually went up to the farm, and I spoke with Levitt, and he told me a lot of things that happened that night. And one thing he told me as he was up there with a battalion of troops, and he actually had received a call from Washington, and he was went onto the Flatwoods farm with 50 to 60 guys, and they stayed the night. That's not in the history books. It was a covert mission. As it's well known, there were troops up there for crowd control in the first 4 to 6 weeks. It was estimated 10,000 people had went into that little town and basically trampled it. You know, this, and that was a big story back then for people to come from all over the country, and they were coming from all over the world as well into this little community, and there was no interstate, so it took a long time to get up into these mountains. It was a big story. And by working with Colonel Levitt, Mrs. May, I eventually spoke to Ailey Stewart Jr., who was the Johnny on the spot reporter, who was actually the first one up to the May's house after the incident. I worked with Jack Davis, a lot of different locals. They gave me the layout of the land of Flatwoods, drove me around for years. All the past research articles and information that I had from Gray Barker and Sanderson, I used and got maps and of the area, and the locals drove me all over the place. I actually know Flatwoods and Braxton County better than I know my own backyard here where I live in Daytona Beach, Florida, because I've spent so many years up there.
You know, there's an interesting parallel here about one aspect of this. Another new book that just came out is the Aztec incident, Aztec, New Mexico, up in the Four Corners area, by Scott and Suzanne Ramsey. And they had the same kind of situation that the old-timers, that happened in 48, mind you, March, outsiders had trouble getting to people, and they didn't want to talk to anybody coming from outside. You know, small town, they don't like being ridiculed, and there was a lot of nonsense published and stuff. And so it took a long time for them to find enough people. Suzanne, fortunately, is from that area. And so the places to stay and stuff. But they really did a research job, just as Frank has done. And you get to people that nobody else had gotten to. Nobody else has filmed Levitt. And he's a very important part of the story. I mean, colonel, military, called from Washington to be there. That adds weight to everything. And it, the contrast between careful researchers like Frank and like the Ramseys and the people like Joe Nickel, the debunker who came to town, didn't even go out to the area where the event happened, didn't talk to Mrs. May. She was, of course, alive at that time. And then he expounds this this six-foot owl story. I mean, jeez, you know, don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. And so it's an interesting situation. Small town, lots of people. And, you know, there's something about a small town. If somebody is a goof-off, a liar, a cheat, et cetera, you find out about it pretty quick. The same thing with regard to Roswell. If you talk to people quietly about somebody who's a key witness, you get a pretty good picture of whether they're respected or disrespected or whatever. And so Frank is fortunate only because he put in 20 years of hard work and he managed to get so many people to talk to him and spent an enormous amount of money and time. And people don't understand that investigation takes effort. You don't just zip into town, talk to a couple of people, oh, I've solved the problem. That's what the debunkers do.
Yeah, with
that's not what Frank
spent,
does.
An afternoon spent in Flatwoods. I wish it was that easy, right, Stan?
Yeah, boy, would I like it to be that easy. I wish somebody would pay my phone bill in the early days of Roswell. Just God knows how much money you've spent, Frank. Enormous amount.
And when Nickel went into the area, he only went into the first pasture. You see, Jeremy, Stanton has been on the Bailey Fisher farm a couple different times. So he's one of the few researcher investigators that's actually been on the farm besides myself and Barker and Sanderson. Not too many people have been up there over the years. And when you get onto the farm, you can really tell by the lay of the land of what happened just standing there. There's actually three different fields. The first field is the wide open pasture field. And then there's a second field that has a gully in it that slopes to the right. And then the far back hill is up on a mountaintop. The craft actually landed on the far back mountaintop of the Bailey Fisher farm at about 7:25 p.m. It had actually relocated into the lower gully off to the right-hand side. And there was a pasture of pear trees back then. Haley Stewart is the one that told me that, by the way, Stanton, when he saw my illustration, he said, you don't have enough of pear trees, and that's where the thing sat off was back there. And I said, oh, thanks, and I had to take my painting out of the frame and then paint that whole section over. But what happened is by the time the witnesses had entered onto the first pasture of the farm, this craft had relocated into the gully. Well, the tree where the encounter took place was beyond the first field to the left of the gully. And when Joe Nickel went up there, somebody drove him around. He never even went up into the second section of the farm. They were driving around in a truck in the first pasture. They never got anywhere near the location where the encounter occurred, or they didn't get up to the back where the craft had touched down. So they were driving aimlessly around in circles doing nothing, Stanton.
That's what you'd expect. Remember, the rules for debunkers are very straightforward. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. What the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. If you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's easier. And do your research by proclamation. Don't bother investigating. It's too much trouble. And Joe followed that, and some of the debunkers on Roswell have done exactly the same thing, and Aztec. And so you get very irked at these experts who don't do a job. Investigation is tough. It's expensive. It's time-consuming. And sometimes you find contradictions. That's the way life is. But you got to keep at it. And, just to give you another example, Joe also solved the Roswell problem the easy way. He and I were on a television show. We couldn't see each other. I was in Roswell. He was in Los Angeles. And he was asked what happened at Roswell. Oh, some PR guy just made up the story to get attention. I said, you don't know his name, do you? No. Well, I've known him for 20 years, and the notion that the PR guy for the most elite military group in the world, of course he hadn't said that, would make up a story, he'd be in the brig in 2 minutes. And I say that because the elite, because they were the only guys in the world who had atomic bombs. They dropped two of them on Japan and two more in tests the next year. That has an important part of the story. Well, 9 years later, Joe was still saying an unnamed public information officer, PIO, put out an unauthorized press release. Basis for that? None. I've talked to many people involved in this story. But it didn't stop the debunkers. And incidentally, people like to think those guys are scientific. Joe's 3 degrees are in English. And he worked as a magician whose basic purpose, of course, is to deceive people watching him. So this is what you're dealing with, that you always have to be wary of the fast explanation, the easy explanation, the obviously everybody's stupid and they're all making up stories and, you know, like there's some benefit to be gained. I don't know by whom, except the people who publish the debunking magazines. So.
Yeah. Well, the same could be said with Flatwoods. The people had nothing to gain Stanton except they were ridiculed, as well as generations of, you know, kids and grandkids. It was your grandmother or your mom that saw Bob. They all start laughing. You know, they make a big joke out of it. They didn't gain anything out of this. None of them wrote any books. You know, they were so fed up with the way everything was handled through the media over the years. And then the We the People program, where the illustrator drew that cockeyed illustration of this monster wearing a cloaked hood like a monk with a long draping dress with claws and arms, you know, and they were just fed up after that. And no personal gain, just a lot of ridicule over the years.
Well, it's good to see that here we are, what, 60 years later, Frank? 60
yes,
years, my goodness. That at least it's been getting a serious attention from people like you. And Alfred and so forth. And it's been good for me to see that some of the people in town have come along too. You know what I mean? When the mayor is willing to talk to you, and you and I both talked to her, you talked to her, Mr. Cleese's mother, and others in town, willing to stand up and be counted. And so it's kind of like Roswell. At first people say, we don't want to be the UFO capital of the world. What are you, crazy? And then when the people started to come, suddenly, you're talking about moving the museum 2 miles away. We can't do that. No. You need it right on Main Street there.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny how they'll come around when they realize that people take them seriously. And so, Flatwoods, you know, how big a town is Flatwoods, Frank, now?
A
few thousand.
A little over 400. John Kleiss filled me in last week, about 425 or something. Up, it was 300 back in 52.
Okay, well, that illustrates the point. We're not talking about a big city. We're not talking about a place where nobody knows anybody else. We're talking about a place where everybody knows everybody else. And the thing is, small-town America may have its problems, especially economic ones. You know, how do you make a living? On the other hand, the people are pretty decent. A good example of that is Travis Walton from Snowflake, Arizona. I've been there, and I talk to other people casually about him and stuff, and you get a handle. Here's somebody who was respected, not known to be a liar, a cheat, somebody making up stories, trying to make a buck on you. He was respected in town. That's what you got to look at. Not just, oh, that's a crazy story. It can't possibly be true. He must have made it up, which seems to be one of the bylines of the debunkers, you know. We're not going to investigate. What, are you kidding? There's nothing to investigate. Anything but alien. It can't be, you know. Is anybody else, your book, I'm so glad that you got out from under your previous publisher, Frank. You know, a lot of people don't realize that you had written a book and it got butchered. Is that a pleasant correct word to use, Frank?
Yeah, straight to the point.
I was going to ask you about that. What is what happened with the old book compared to the new one, like with the publisher?
What happened is the book was edited down. It was a massive manuscript. Stanton had read the manuscript. I mailed it to him upon his request. And when I got together with the publisher, he started whittling the book down and cutting it down and cutting it down. I wasn't too happy with that right off the bat, but I understood it had to be kept, you know, reasonably to a publishing size within, you know, a little over 300 pages. So I was able to live with that. Wasn't happy with it, but I went along with it. What happened is after that point, the book went into print, and I went to West Virginia. I started doing some shows with Stanton. I went on book tour. I was set up in different parts of the state. The main hub was Charleston. And to make a long story short, what happened is people were hearing Stanton and I on radio broadcasts. And people were purchasing my book and coming back after they read it, and they would say, wow, you did a heck of a show with Stanton Friedman on such and such a show. How come you didn't talk about that in your book? That's a pretty important part. And I'm like, what, are you crazy? Of course it's an important part. I wrote it in the book. It's chapter 2. And they would open it up and call me on it. And I'm like, oh, my God, it's not there. What happened is the publisher edited the book and chopped it to pieces one more time and put it into print and didn't tell me. I had a book that was very inconsistent, had typos in it, maps were mislabeled, some of them had the wrong areas of locations, because it could get to be a very involved story. Flatwoods was just one small part of it. There was 21 hours of sustained sightings on September 12, 1952. There were 4 damaged craft that came into the United States, 1 from the south, 3 from the mid-Atlantic region, and they were crashing all over the country. One of them that touched down was in Flatwoods. It was the craft that flew over Washington that the New York Times reported on September 13, 1952. They called it the Flame Over Washington. So the story was very involved, and it was just edited horrendously. And I barely even recognized the book. Now, here I am. I'm on book tour up there. I'm talking to different people, and I'm calling Stanton up in Canada explaining what happened. I'm like, Stanton, by the time I went from Florida to West Virginia set up, and, you know, there was a lot of excitement and hype at that point. And people were just basically buying a book, and they were coming back and showing it to me, and it was riddled with mistakes. It took me years to get the rights back because I was under a book contract with a West Virginia publisher, and I had to document the mistakes, and my attorneys at Bowles and Rice and Charleston took my case, and there was 154 mistakes in the book. That's a lot of mistakes.
Wow.
154 documented, and we ended up going into a settlement agreement just to get the publishing rights so I can get my story back. I didn't get one nickel or a dime out of this whole thing. I just wanted my story back and to break the contract. And the attorneys at Bowles and Rice and Charleston were able to do that. And the contract was severed. What I did is I had to put the book all back together from the original manuscripts. And basically from that point in 2004, 2005, I just continued my research. And, you know, and I'm putting together a case too, building it up against, you know, in its law settlement against the publisher. That took up a lot of time, pulling together my evidence. And I was working with Stanton, you know, in the meantime, building this case in case it went to court, but it ended up being settled out of court. Meanwhile, I was in touch with Stanton, and we just kept rolling and rolling and moving forward with the Flatwoods case. There was tons of photographs, maps, and illustrations that were cut out of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hard to read along the storyline. So what I did, being an illustrator and being pretty good at computers and graphics and illustrations and drawings and paintings, I reformatted the entire book and put in over 220 graphics, photographs, hand-cut maps. I did everything on my own, exactly like how the book should have been in the first place, except with all my new additions put into it. So now, at this point, there's over 20 years of my research and investigation piled into this one book. And the book weighs 1.53 pounds, Stan, and it's another big one.
Yeah, I know. I got mine.
It's a big book. Has a lot of information in it, and this is my 20 years of hard work piled into that one piece. So
I should mention,
I'm happy with it now.
I wrote the foreword and the epilogue, if people are wondering what I had to do with this thing. So I can, honestly say my name is on the cover. Foreword and epilogue by nuclear physicist Stanton T. Friedman. How do you like that, huh? And it's a colorful cover.
Another important part here is people don't realize is Stanton's been up there a couple times, and when Stanton was up there for the 50th anniversary, he actually met Mayor Kleiss, Peggy Kleiss. She saw the craft fly over Flatwoods that night. Stanton also met Kathleen May, Freddie May, one of the primary witnesses, and Eddie May. He met the entire May family. And we also met, who came in for the 50th anniversary, was Ronnie Shaver. Ronnie Shaver was one of the witnesses who was just a few feet behind Kathleen May. So Stanton and I met just about everybody involved in the case up there in that three-day event that we had. And since then, some of the witnesses have passed away. And that's Stanton's old war cry about battling the Undertaker.
Racing the Undertaker, and we usually lose.
Yeah, well, in this case, we were lucky. When I went to film school after I moved to Florida, I learned how to operate big video professional cameras, and I was running back and forth to West Virginia for several years taping witnesses, and I actually taped Colonel Levitt when he's spilled everything out to me on the farm the second time we went up there. The first time he told me of his involvement of what happened, I just took notes, but he wouldn't let me tape him. Subsequently, he let me videotape him, and I stood up on the farm for an hour, about 45 minutes of what he told me, how with his involvement, how he was contacted by Washington that night and told to go up there and get samples. And
nobody else talked to him, I better add.
Yeah, not that I know of, Stanton. And it was like pulling teeth to get him to talk to. I was a little nervous at first because I knew he was a hard ass, Colonel Levitt. He was a little short, stocky guy. After that, I tracked down Ailey Stewart Jr., who was the Johnny on the spot and the first one up there of authority. When the Flatwoods story happened that night, the West Virginia State Police were not in the area. They were out on calls, and the sheriff and deputy of Braxton County were running all over, like chickens with their heads cut off, all over the Flatwoods, Gassaway, Duck Creek area within a 10 to 15 mile radius of Flatwoods, chasing down reports of crafts and airplanes and objects going down throughout the area. There was actually two damaged UFOs in Braxton County that night. And the original investigators were trying to piece together what happened. This is why it took close to 20 years to figure this story out, because there was so much activity going on up there. And Ailey Stewart got a call from the police, and he was told to go up to the May home that night because there were reports of a monster. He was contacted by the police because he was a photojournalist and he had a nice big fancy camera. So he used to run around with the state police taking crime scene pictures and accidents and whatnot, you know, bodies chalked out on the ground. So he was pretty in tight with the police because they were unable to respond to Mrs. May's frantic call of her and a bunch of kids seeing this 12-foot monster. Stewart was the first person of authority up there, and he walked into the house within minutes after the pandemonium was going on, and Mrs. May and the kids were freaking out and crying and screaming. Some of the kids were bruised and cut up from falling down, running back down off the mountain. And he was a key person, and it took me years to find him. And when I eventually tracked him down, he was living in North Carolina. And I spoke to him on the phone and for a little while, and he invited me up to his home the following weekend. And I actually drove from Daytona Beach up to the Kill Devil Hills area where Stewart lived, and I stayed there for 3 to 4 days. He had a spare bedroom in this nice house, and I just hung out there with him for the entire time. We went over the story. I showed him some of the articles that I had accumulated up to that point in 1996, and we went over this whole thing. I set up a camera, and he told me the entire story of the Braxton County Monster and his involvement of it, working with the kids, trying to trick the kids into, getting different answers and responses. So he was actually the first person to interview all of the witnesses, Stanton. Barker and Sanderson came in later on, week later. So
well, Stewart
really
also did something else. He commented about the kids being sick. Remember, Frank?
Right.
And he saw it. It wasn't put on. There was this business about gas or whatever it was emitted by this monster, in quotes, and the kids got sick. Well, he talked to the kids. He saw the kids. He knew that it wasn't a put-on. It wasn't just a story somebody made up later on. And testimony like that is invaluable. I mean, here's a respected journalist, a photographer, respected by the police and stuff, and he was on the spot. But nobody else really got the story, and nobody went after him.
He told me that he wanted to go up to the spot. Now, this is just shortly after the incident happened. And he said nobody would take him back up because they were scared out of their wits. And he said one of the older boys was so scared under his breath, he was crying like a whipped pup. And Stewart actually grabbed him by the back of the neck and dragged him up there because the kids were just petrified. This wasn't an owl. An owl doesn't scare you like that and make you sick. And like the government said, they imagined the rest they saw, and probably an owl in a tree. You know, that's crazy. Stewart got together an armed posse. They went up there armed. He told me they had double-barrel shotguns. They had handguns. This wasn't a stroll under the moonlit sky. They were up there in full force, and most of the people up there are armed who live up in the mountains, and they got this posse together, and they all walked up onto that farm. And the reason he grabbed one of the boys was because they wanted to know where it happened. You know, they were walking into the pitch dark up there in the mountains. That's scary in itself, let alone a monster. So when Stewart got up there, he said that the boys were talking about the smell, and it was like a burnt sulfur smell. And his background, his Air Force background, the chemical warfare, he knew that gases settle quickly to the ground. And that's when he told me he got down on the ground, and he was kneeling and smelling, and he smelled the residue of that gas sulfur stuff that was settled into the grass and the dirt. He said they had a couple big, what he called electric lanterns. They were big, gigantic flashlights. They flashed them throughout the area, and he said none of us were inclined to hunt for something in the dark that we didn't know what it was. So so they just stayed up there. You know, here's a bunch of adults up there with guns. They didn't know what the heck was going on, and they were even scared. And at that point, the incident had occurred, and the so-called monster, which was actually a metallic structure, it was like a hovercraft spacesuit, it had departed and went from the area, and it went back to the craft, and the craft took off, and it was seen flying in a southern, southwestern direction towards the area of Frametown. So Stewart came back, and he went to the house with the boys. The posse broke up, and he spoke to Mrs. May and a couple of the kids, and he wanted to know if he could come back early in the morning to interview them. And what he did is he actually got a tape recorder from the fella in town who ran the movie house. And he spoke to his attorney that night, and he wanted to get credit with this Flatwoods Monster story when it broke. And the story was released to the Charleston Gazette and Charleston Daily Mail, and the first articles appeared on Sunday. When I started looking into these articles, I was traveling up to West Virginia, and I was going to the different major archives and libraries up there, mainly in Charleston. I went to some of the smaller little regional ones in Braxton County, but there wasn't too much there. What I found out by looking at the September 13th articles, what this is the day after the Flatwoods case, is these reports throughout the eastern United States, not of a monster because the story hadn't broke yet, of all of these thousands of sightings of flying saucers, UFOs, objects, crashing planes, and I started putting together maps of combining these different maps together, and I have, you could see it on flatwoodsmonster.com right on the homepage, click on map. I used a gigantic major map, master map, which I call it, and I pinpointed over the years every time I found a sighting. I was able to get the Project Blue Book documents, and during that course of the 5 years of putting together, re-inking everything and figuring out the different sightings, I started adding more dots and plots to this map. At one point early on years ago, I was telling Stan Friedman about all of these different UFOs seen in the area, and Stanton contacted Barry Greenwood and some other colleagues, and they pulled together more articles. And when I thought my research was finished, I got a big gigantic box in the mail. I opened it up and I almost had a heart attack. I'm like, oh my God, I got to rewrite the book again. And I spent more time adding. And in the end, I have 102 plotted and documented points over 9 eastern states over 21 hours where UFO sighting took place.
We should stress there now that 1952 is the biggest year in Blue Book history. And also, the attempt to make all these sightings into meteors is hilarious. I mean, meteors have certain characteristics. When they hit the ground, they make a big hole. They make a big sound. They don't come in gently. You know, they don't land. Some of the stories, the attempts to make meteors fit, just don't do it. I mean, we know how fast they move and how they move, and these weren't meteors. You might think they were if you only listened to the noisy negativists. You know, oh yeah, obviously a meteor, and oh yeah, it was seen over there too, just a meteor. But when you start digging carefully, as Frank did, then you realize, hey, these weren't meteors. And if you go to the Meteoritic Society and look at their reports on major meteors during the year, you know, there weren't any that matched any of these cases. So, you know, don't bother me with the facts my mind's made of.
Yeah, and in West Virginia, there's only 3 known meteorite finds. They're in Greenbrier County in 1880 and 1883, era Jenny's Creek, and then the famous 1930 Landes, Grant County, West Virginia.
Well, what's a little time travel for a meteor, Frank? Yep. They tried to do it with Roswell. The dummies that were dropped 6 years after Roswell were supposedly responsible.
And what's even more interesting is the Harvard Meteor Project that took place between 52 and 54. The project had obtained 2,401 photographic meteor orbits. And interestingly, there are no recordings of any meteors for September 12, 1952 in the Harvard Meteor Project archives. And the United States government, well, the Project Blue Book intelligence officers actually called this meteor the well-known Washington area meteor of September 12th landing near Flatwoods. And when you look up the different pieces of information that they had released, it's interesting that the object, how fast it was going, the duration was 5 to 6 seconds, and you know, this what it was called, they assumed that this thing had burned out. Well, what happened is the speed was listed, the actual velocity, at 27 miles per second. This thing flew over Washington, D.C. about 7 p.m. standard time, and it landed in Flatwoods 25 minutes later. If that thing was going 27 miles per second, it would have taken a few seconds to get into Flatwoods, not 25 minutes. The object was actually going somewhere just a little over 400 miles an hour. And it was seen passing west over Washington, and it flew, and it was sighted by an aircraft over the area of Front Royal, Virginia. It continued to go west. When it crossed into West Virginia, it hit upper Braxton County. Then it redirected, as a meteor will do, make a 45-degree angle turn.
Sure, all the time, Frank.
Yeah, and then it passed and it headed south a few miles down. It turned again and headed southeast, and that's when it landed on a Bailey Fisher farm. That's when the kids saw it. So you have something that was seen across the whole United States, and it traveled approximately 206 miles from the point when it passed over Washington till it landed in Flatwoods. And something very interesting, when I started going into Flatwoods a little bit more after I met Jack Davis. Jack Davis was an adult witness. He was a businessman in the area. And Jack actually saw the Flatwoods monster craft coming in to the area damaged at treetop level. He was on another part of the town, Stanton. He was on the other end of the town looking at it from a different perspective. And, you know, it was quite interesting talking to Jack. He actually sat down with me, and we drew these pictures, and I came up with the illustrations of what this thing looked like. Jack saw it coming over the town, and it went over and stopped in midair, and it dropped. And he says when it landed on the top of the Fisher Farm, he could actually see it glowing and pulsing through the trees. It was this purplish color. Well, Jack, on one trip up there years ago, Stan, he wanted to give me the lay of the land of Flatwoods. And he started driving me through these back windy roads up in the mountains. I was lost. And I was a few miles away from the site. I had no idea where we were. Pulled the car on the side of the road and jumped out, and he says, "Follow me." We climbed over this fence onto private property, and we walked across, and there's signs all over the place, "No trespassing." He says, "Oh, I know this guy. Don't worry about it." So we walk over this pasture, we hit a ridge, and then start walking down. And Stanton, I was looking at Flatwoods from the west direction, looking east. And Jack says, "Look out across that road way down there, and what do you see?" And Stanton, all you see is trees, just mountains and trees all over the place, except for one little area. And Jack pointed, and he says, "You see that over there? It looks like a bald spot." And right in the middle of the forest and all these mountains, it looks like a bald spot on somebody's head. That's where the object touched down. was right in that pasture, way over
there. And that's from somebody who was there and saw it happen.
Right, and he it was in his head for years and years and years. And you realize it once you got way back at a little bit higher point and you look down, it was no accident. This thing just happened to crash into that area. This thing came down controlled, and that's what Jack told me. This thing was being flown. It was controlled. And you see the big picture when you look at this thing from a different point of view. And that's what the locals were doing up there with me, staying for years. They were driving me around, showing me all these different points, what had happened, where, the locations. And when I was putting together the layout for the book and reenacting everything that happened that night, I was able to do it within a few minutes because I was driven around the town. So I knew how long it took for the sheriff to get from the sheriff's department over to Sugar Creek, then back. He picked up the deputy. He went back and forth, and I actually drove with my buddy Rob, which Stanton knows, and he drove, and I tracked the mileage down off of the odometer, and we were able to figure out how long it took, and that's how I was able to establish and recreate this whole story from talking to the locals. And the roads haven't changed much up there except for the interstate. They're basically the same. So this is how I was able to put together such a precise timeline of events of what happened that night.
Well, you know, Frank, maybe we ought to give your website out for the listeners so they know where to get even more information. Why don't you tell us your website?
It's flatwoodsmonster.com.
Oh, that's difficult, Frank.
I was going to say, what's the website for our listeners if they want to go buy your book or go check that out?
You could just go right on to flatwoodsmonster.com, and the first thing you'll see is a cover of a new book. You'll scroll down a little bit further, and that's where you'll see the area where it says Master Map. And you could look at the map, and you could scroll, and you could look at it. And that's where you'll see the 102 locations where these UFOs were seen.
Can they use PayPal to buy your book, Frank?
Yeah, you could. It will take you from my site right to the Lulu.com site, and that's where you can purchase the book, Stan.
Oh, okay.
And get it directly from the printers.
Yeah, and I mention only because not all books are available everywhere, and so if you got a direct line to where you can get it, that's the way to go. And
Right when you click on the cover of the book, it's set up. It goes directly right to the printers. And
oh,
the book
good.
Is actually in the history section, Stanton, the category. And
wow.
It's number two. It's ranked number two.
That's great.
Sales.
That's
so
great.
Getting some attention here, and it is a historical book. It's not a folklore or a fairy tale like so many people were led to believe years ago.
Well, that's right. And it takes the kind of in-depth investigation that you've done, Frank, just the Ramses did with regard to Aztec, and it puts to shame all these fast answer guys. Debunkers are, I always knew that that was a fraud, and, you know, that's the easy way out. I didn't do any investigation, but I don't need to because I know it couldn't be anything special. You know, that attitude infuriates me, you understand. Well, I've been to 20 archives. I know how much work it takes to get the story right. You know, it's not like it happened yesterday and you've got six guys with video cameras recording everything that happened. You got to go back in time and you got to take advantage of every opportunity. And you know, what I've found about witness testimony is that people are pretty good observers. Their interpretation may be all wet. But if you don't give them leading questions, in other words, what angle was it above the horizon, not how far away and how high it was, because you can't judge those things. And respect your witness, but make sure you ask your questions carefully. And, you know, it's kind of funny. Some of the people who debunk UFOs, there are people who they themselves have found meteorites based on eyewitness testimony. In other words, if you get 40 people saying, well, it was moving in that direction at that time, at that angle, and so forth, And it's amazing. People have found recovered meteorites because the witness testimony was accurate. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with, how do you know most sightings can be explained? Venus, for example. Because the witness description was right. It was seen at that direction, at that time, at that angle above the horizon. It was brighter than anything else around. They didn't know what it was. That's often the case. But you couldn't identify it, as a serious investigator can find out what it was, by asking sensible questions and doing a thorough investigation. And so I often have these people say, oh, eyewitness testimony is worth nothing. Well, except if we can explain it, you see. Then it's worth everything. So you can't have it both ways. In other words, people's testimony can only be trusted if you can explain it away as something conventional. Otherwise, no, don't believe eyewitness testimony. That's nonsense. How many people would have a different story on, let's say, the O.J. Simpson case, if there had been an eyewitness to that? You know, would be altogether different. So we got to be real cautious about blaming people for being poor witnesses. And, you know, I asked a local police officer here in Fredericton, New Brunswick, where I live, and I said, when there's a high visibility case and you ask the public to help out, call this number or something, if you know anything at all, I said, do you get a lot of response? He says, oh, yeah, we get tons of response. I said, what percentage of the response is useful? Oh, 3 or 4%, but that's how we solve most crimes. So, you know, you got to be like the gold miner. I just read yesterday, with the high price of gold today, gold ore is worth mining if there's a gram of gold per ton of ore. Think about that for a minute. So it's mostly not gold, but there's enough gold there to make it worth mining. And it's the same with UFOs. Yeah, most sightings can be explained. So what? Who cares? It's the ones that can't be, like this one, that matter.
There were no.
Well, I hate to interrupt you, but we have a caller calling in. And you're on?
Yes. Hi, Frank. How are you doing?
Good. Who's this?
Oh, I'm Nick, one of the other members of Bigfoot's Pad Paranormal.
Hey, Nick. How you doing, man?
Doing good. I really haven't had a chance to dig too much into your new book, and I've just got it, and I've skimmed through it. I really like the added illustrations, and the writing style seems to be a bit more streamlined in this book than the last one.
That's because I wrote it, this one. And I edited it, and I illustrated it. Thank you.
The question I was wondering personally was, last time I talked to you, you said that you were trying to find more out about what was going on with that tree on the site where the monster was at. I said,
right.
You know, is there any updates on that or not really right now?
From the results of the Monster Quest show, it was there was no conclusions, but we're still working on it. I had another analysis done on it, and it was still inconclusive. And every time I see the tree, and there's actually a couple shots on the website of it, and there's photographs in the book of this tree.
What's left of it?
Deteriorating. Yeah, what's left of it? When I started going up there years ago, it was approximately 9 to 10 foot tall, and it was it looked like a big, gigantic cannoli shell. It was hollow. You could actually punch your fist right through the tree, and a few feet up, it was rotted. And, you know, you could actually put your hand right through the tree and grab out the middle of it. It was basically just, you know, like spongy and soft. And since then, the tree has split in half and fallen down, and there are no guts of the tree. It's just one big shell, and there's hardly anything left to it at this point. And in the book, I have some photographs of the tree that I had taken over the past 20 years, and I have pictures of the tree back from the 52-53 era. And I'm putting together a trailer for the book right now, and I'm going to have some photographs and some video footage of that I had taken of the tree. Right now, the farm, the Bailey Fisher farm, was sold a few years ago, and it looks like a fancy dude ranch up there. When I was getting the professional cameras 18, 19, 20 years ago, I was going up there and I videotaped just about every square inch of that farm. And when I was able to interview Freddie May, who was one of the primary witnesses, Mrs. May's younger son, he took me up onto the farm and he gave me a walkthrough step by step, which is very helpful. We started out at the school playground, then we went to the old May home. We went up the path onto the first pasture, up the to the second pasture where you walked up to the left-hand side was the dirt fence, the dirt path just past the fence, and all the way up onto the mountaintop. So Freddie gave me a nice walkthrough of the whole area. That's how I knew the story so well. Kathleen was older at that point, and she wasn't going to go trekking through the mountains with me. She gave me a lot of good firsthand information, and while I was doing my illustrations, I was able to sit down with these witnesses and do these police-style renderings. I would sit out doing sketches. I would sit next to Mrs. May and Freddie May, and a great point of what I'm telling you this story is Mrs. May came within 12 to 14 feet of this so-called monster, which was a metallic structure. She came right up on top of this thing. She flashed her flashlight on it, and it reacted. And the reason I say that is because I asked her. This thing was a machine. It was in a dormant state. When she flashed the flashlight on it, it lit up from the inside and glowed, and it moved towards her. And this machine spewed out, it was leaking some type of an oily substance. It was a little bit thicker consistency than oil, and it splattered and hit the front of her uniform. So Kathleen saw this thing up close and personal. Freddie, her son, was set back a few feet. He had come to the second gate, which was a wooden gate, and it had, at the time in 52, there was big wooden slats that were nailed from post to post. They've fallen down since then, but the original posts are still there. Freddie had come to that fence with a couple of the other younger kids and his dog and Gene Lemon's dog. Those dogs refused to go any further. He told me he was just climbing up the slats of the fence when his mother flashed the flashlight up towards the left of this oak tree, set about 4 feet back. So Freddie saw the whole thing unfold in front of him. Kathleen saw it up close. So when you look at my illustrations online, you could actually see on the book cover what actually happened and from my different illustrations. And that's how I was able to establish that this monster, so-called monster, quotes, was a metallic structure. And Freddie May and Kathleen likened it to a gigantic hovering spacesuit. And it looked like it was something being controlled from the inside. Freddie believed there was something in there. It was like a spacesuit. It was definitely mechanical. Then you have the old myth of the arms and claws that were drawn by the original We the People sketch artists on September 1952. And what they actually were some type of antenna devices that were coming off the plane of the shoulders. The original drawing had this big cloaked hood going over an Ace of Spades type affair, like a cowl over the top of its head. It wasn't made out of cloth. It was like a metallic structure. This whole thing was made out of steel. Freddie told me the front of this over the face area was like a plate of glass, like plexiglass. It was a protective barrier. The head was not actually a head. It was an inner helmet. And Kathleen and Freddie both had likened this whole affair of the head with the cowl is like looking into the cockpit of a fighter jet. And the canopy is covering the pilot, and he has his headgear on with his mask, you know, his goggles. And that's what Freddie said. The red head was actually like an inner helmet. this inner helmet did not have eyes. And that was another big fable to the Flatwoods story, as though the monster had big bulging eyes. Freddie and Kathleen both told me they were actually portholes to this inner helmet, and they were gigantic. When the monster had emitted the beams coming out from his eyes, they weren't deadly laser beams, how they portray in these Japanese video games and whatnot. What they actually were is, Freddie told me this one time. We were standing outside and getting ready to leave. He had said something to the effect of, when the lights are on, the dashboard lights on the cockpit inside your car, okay, when the car turns on at night, the interior lights up and it forms a glow within the car. He said when that thing lit up, when his mom hit it with the flashlight, it was a machine, it was in a dormant state. When this thing came to life, it lit up from the inside, and because the porthole openings, okay, because they were openings, when this thing lit up from the inside, the light was forced out through the holes. They were beams of light forced out from the interior. So this was definitely some type of a machine. They weren't laser beams, just light that was forced out of the holes. And when this thing had lifted off the ground, it came in front of Kathleen May from her left. It hovered down a little incline, came within about 14 feet or so of her, and that's when this thing was simultaneously leaking and splattering oil out all over the place. Colonel Levitt was able to obtain some of this oil. It seems everybody in Flatwoods that went up there found some of this oil, but Colonel Levitt actually was ordered to take the samples. He found pieces of little black plastic-like material and little pieces of metal. Stewart found some of the metal. He says it looked like drip solder. It was about the size of his thumb. And so there was a lot of evidence found on the farm.
But it was sent off, remember.
Yeah, it was. Levitt sent it off to Washington. And Mrs. May also told me that there was a couple guys that had come up there right after the incident, and they posed as newspaper reporters. And they were trying to get information from Kathleen, and she just basically didn't have the time for them. There were so many people up on that farm, it was like, you know, complete pandemonium. People were running all over, you know, like crazy. There were kids up there, adults, newspaper writers. So these guys came back to Kathleen's home the following day, and Kathleen said they explained to her that they were from intelligence. They were government men, and they wanted to know what happened up there. Well, a funny story, Stanton, is when Kathleen was telling me the story, it's when she lived over her in her apartment over in Gassaway. And I was sitting in her living room, and she was telling me this story, and she was sitting in her big easy chair, and she started explaining how when these two men were talking to her, they were in the field with Freddie. Eddie was sick. He didn't feel good. He was up closer right near Kathleen, and he had inhaled some of these fumes of this sulfur, this sulfuric gas. Freddie was standing up in the field, and that's where they were looking at these big track marks. What these track marks actually were, and Stewart, the reporter, told me this, they were basically parallel lines, and they were over 4 feet wide, and they looked like a big gigantic leaf blower. Somebody had walked through with a 4 foot wide leaf blower and cut a path through the grass. The path came from the circled area, compressed area where the craft had touched down, and it moved up towards the tree after the encounter. The second path went parallel to the first and went back to the area where the grass was pressed down. Stewart was the first one up onto the farm the following morning. He was up there when the sun came up, and he went up into the area, and he was checking everything out, and that's when he found the big chunk of metal that looked like melted solder. and because it was glimmering with the sun was hitting across the farm and it caught his eye. So what we have here is a lot of evidence found through the area, and that was confiscated. But getting back to Kathleen's story, she said these two men were standing there talking to her, and one of them asked her where the encounter occurred, and she pointed them up into the direction where the tree is. Stan's been to that tree a couple times.
Yeah.
The intelligence man went up into that area, Stanton, and he went down over into the back of the wooded area. And Kathleen said he came back a little bit while later, and this is when she started laughing. And she's sitting in her big easy chair, and she kicked forward, and Kathleen stood up. And she said he walked up to us, and he had a beautiful light-colored suit on with a hat. And she said he was covered from head to toe in oil. And Kathleen started laughing. She said he looked like a striped zebra. She said because the oil from the Flatwoods machine had splattered, left the puddle where it was actually sitting, and then as it was moving, it was splattering all over the place, and it was hitting the branches of the trees. She said, and she held her arms out at her side. She went, Frank, he went like this, and he was covered in oil and dripping, and he was striped because of the branches. She said every part of him was covered in oil, and he walked up to the other intelligence agent that was standing there with Kathleen and Freddie, and he said, I wonder what Ed's going to think about this when we send this in for analysis. And she says, I never will forget his name, Ed. She said he specifically said Ed. And it hit me right off the top who Ed was. Edward was Edward Ruppel, who was head of Project Blue Book in 1952. Kathleen didn't know that. She just knew Ed. She says, I specifically remember him saying, I wonder what Ed's going to think about this. And she said, Frank, he was, she put her arms out on their side. She said he was covered. And what happened at that point is Kathleen had mentioned how she got splattered on the front with the oil. And these two intelligence officers went back down to her house, and they got her uniform, and they scraped the oil out of her uniform with like a little device, like a knife. And they obtained that oil from her. They didn't take her uniform. She said they just scraped all the oil out of it. And
nobody ever got the test results, though. Not on our side of the fence.
And she said she eventually threw that away, the uniform. She just chucked it out. So we do have intelligence people who were up there on the farm. So it was taken very seriously. This whole case was taken.
As it should have been.
As it should have been. It wouldn't.
I mean, the government, if you look at the one of the Majestic 12 documents, it talks, there's only three that I consider legitimate, but one of them talks about how the number of sightings rapidly increased from about May until the 1952 until November. And certainly there was a lot going on, and certainly there had to be government concern about, you know, what was going to happen. And Frank and I have talked about the fact that people don't realize it now, but there was great concern that the Russians were going to be attacking. So all these darn UFOs just got in the way. A lot of people don't realize that there was an attitude in the United States in the late 40s. General Groves, who headed the Manhattan Project, estimated it would take the Russians at least 8 years, this is in like 48, before they could have an atomic bomb, because they didn't have the industrial capacity that the United States had. And furthermore, they had no means for delivering it. So we didn't have, people don't realize this, we didn't have a big radar net around the United States at that time. And then in 49, the Russians exploded their first A-bomb in August of 1949. And suddenly, it was also shown when they had one of these flybys over Moscow and stuff, they copied a B-29 that had been left there. They back-engineered it, if you will, made it into and built a bunch of Russian planes just like it. So all of a sudden, there was great concern that Stalin was going to attack. He had atomic bombs, and I read a document at the Truman Library from the National Security Council, one of their meetings. A guy said that we found that the basically what he was saying was that the Russians made more progress in the past 18 months than had been expected for 5 years with regard to the development of atomic bombs and methods for delivering them. So you can imagine that the great concern with radar, with things flying over the country, what the heck is going on here, and how do you sort out this stuff? Those darn aliens are getting in the way. How do you sort that out from Russian planes? And many people may not remember, like us old guys, that they had the system where people would stand guard and would report sightings of airplanes, ground observers corps. Yeah. And the reason they had that is because they didn't have a radar net. You know, people forget that.
Radar
and,
capability in 52 was only 5,000 feet and above, anything under 5,000 feet off the radar. So that's what the ground observer corps did, is they picked up everything under 5,000 feet and reported it.
So what I'm getting at is that there is a military and a psychological and other aspects to this. 52 was a tough time. And, Frank, you still got in your book, you got all those airplanes that had fatal crashes, too, don't you? That was one of the surprising things.
The Shoot 'Em Down book. That was a previous book. Stanton and I worked pretty tight on that and discovered how many planes had went down during that era. And Shoot 'Em Down, I did a case study from 1951 to 1956, and I used the New York Times as my base. And it was sickening how many American pilots had disappeared, vanished into thin air. You're having 2, 3, 4, 5 multiple jet crashes all hitting at once, no mid-air collisions, lots of crazy stuff going on, and especially in 1952. And it's well documented, the Project Blue Book Unknown cases in the 1950s of military fighter jets encountering UFOs. It's unbelievable. All the information is right there, Stanton. You know, just people didn't take the time to look at it. And we have the famous Ed Ruppelt quote about there have been other and more lurid duels of death. And that was in his 1956 book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. So there was a lot of encounters going on then.
And I should make note of the fact that five of the pilots, there were 200 fatal crashes. 200. And five of the pilots had over 100 missions in Korea, where there were MiGs chasing them. If you can survive 100 missions in Korea when you got hostile aircraft coming at you all the time, you're a pretty good pilot. They go back to the United States, no MiGs, and five of them died in crashes. That seems a little unusual to me, anyway.
Yeah, quite a bit.
And remember that lawyer that I talked to, a Navy pilot, who was on duty in one of the Carolinas and at 10 o'clock at night or so, and he gets scrambled, and they vector him to the right place, and he gets up there about 20,000 feet. Well, where is he? And he looks down, and there's the UFO down there. It comes straight up, then comes at him, and there's a beam of light coming from it to him, and he holds his hand up, and he can see the bones in his hand. You can imagine how that felt. So what's he going to do? Of course, it's a hostile act coming right at him. He pulls the trigger on his guns. And they hadn't been loaded, unfortunately. And
Balaco, right, Stanton?
Yeah, you got it.
Balaco.
And he is talking to the controller all the time about, you know, what he's doing, what happened, and as soon as he lands, he gets interrogated for hours by guys in suits and guys in uniform. And he was still around a couple of years ago. I spoke with him more than once. And a lawyer, I mean, for some people that might be a bad sign, but... But
that case is well documented going back into the 50s, Stan. It's not something that just came out all of a sudden.
Oh, right.
When you interviewed him, he was telling the same story as he was years ago. NICAP reported that, right.
And the interesting thing is that we agreed that probably the only reason he was alive is that somebody had forgotten to load the guns on the airplane. But what intrigued me as much as anything was these guys who interviewed him. And his feeling was that they had heard similar stories before. This wasn't the first time they'd heard something like this. So this story, Flatwoods, happens right in the middle of this huge collection of stories that most people have never heard of. And if it wasn't for Frank's documentation, probably would never hear of. Now they can read it in the book, the fully corrected, advanced form out of the book. And it becomes a keynote story because there's so much information about it. And that's what distinguishes the good cases. It's kind of like Roswell. There are a lot of people involved. And you got to go scraping around and looking around and trying to find them and interview them separately before they die. And the same with Aztec. Most of those people are dead now, but they're on record. The Ramses caught them, most of them, before they died, of course. And so this is what you got to look for on a good UFO case. It isn't just I was standing there and saw this thing come fly over the place and, wow, it was exciting. It's dog work. It's finding people. It's talking to those people, getting collateral information from other people who lead you to somebody else. This is what ufology is really about. It's not lights in the sky. We're well beyond that stage. We don't need to worry about them. We're looking for that gram of gold per ton of ore, and this case is one of them.
Well, a big important part here is about 6 weeks before the Flatwoods incident, where we had, I documented four damaged crafts landing throughout the United States and puddle jumping. We have the International News Service report that was released from July 29, 1952. And the article from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, are Air Force orders jet pilots to shoot down flying saucers if they refuse to land. And it states, Lieutenant Colonel Monsell Montz, information officer, stated the jet pilots are and have been under orders to investigate unidentified objects and to shoot them down if they can't talk them down. In Air Force parlance, this means that if a flying saucer refuses to land, jet pilots are authorized to shoot them to Earth if they can get close enough to do so. And this was 6 weeks. This revelation was made 6 weeks right before the Flatwoods incident.
Yeah.
And then we have four damaged UFOs that came into the United States. What I have that's very interesting in this book, as you read the readers follow along through it, Stanton, is at the end of the book I have a reference chapter. And I actually have the times, dates, locations of the 102 sightings areas. And they're all plotted points. So as you're reading through the book, if you want to look in the back, you can follow the storyline. I have everything listed in chronological order. I have the locations of all the crash site areas. So if anybody else out there is reading the book and they want to investigate this thing a little bit further, you can actually, I have the pinpointed areas where these crafts were seen and where they went down, their descriptions. Interestingly, a good chunk of these reports actually came from Project Blue Book. Even though they reported this object was seen for 5 to 6 seconds, we have several hours of sightings of crafts over the Washington, D.C., Virginia, and Maryland area. and we have witnesses that were amazed, who were scared while driving in their cars. The tentative observer questionnaires would ask something to the effect of, what do you think this was? And people were responding by saying, I have no idea what it was, but I was in fear for my life because this thing was going to land near us. And, you know, people were just basically driving around D.C. that night. They were walking their kids in their strollers, walking their dogs, having ice creams. It was basically a heat wave that night. A lot of people were outside, and these things are flying all over the Washington, D.C. area at treetop level in many cases, Stan. That was amazing. These things, I have new documents that I found that I inserted into the new book, new intelligence documents, that just further reinforce my story and my case and my timeline. I found a lot of new documentations, and I would just follow the times. Actually, a new one is a Navy intelligence report. The Navy was working with the Air Force, and there was a huge flying saucer that was seen over Maryland, flying at treetop level. And a lot of different new pieces. Another sighting in Washington, D.C. on September 13th. And basically what we have here is tons of sightings, and since I was able to establish the flight paths of these objects, the second I saw a new document or found a new document, I was able to read it, look at the time, date, location, flight path trajectory, and it fit right into the timeline. So the book has been reinforced and is a lot more solid at this point. It's basically just connecting the dots.
I should mention something else here, Frank.
Right.
As you know, I've now had seven different stories of military pilots going up to chase UFOs and not coming back. And one of them was right in the middle of this 1952 wave. Guy called me after a radio program, and he was at a base, and two guys went up, and one of them didn't come back. They chased the UFO. And he said also they were scrambling for a long time, not just those few days, you know, the Washington, D.C. sightings and stuff like that, but went on for a long time. So if I've heard seven stories, how many more are there? Surely not everybody, you know, has talked to me. And that gets scary. How many of them were ready to pull the trigger, and the UFO said, no way, Jose, and
yeah,
took care of him.
In this book, I go very in-depth into the disappearance of an F-94 Starfire that vanished over the Gulf of Mexico near Florida on a routine weather training mission. And Stanton actually got the 68-page document from the archives in Norton Air Force Base accident report, aircraft accident report. I had the original articles that were released to the press within a couple days. The story never reached outside of the state of Florida, interestingly. It was never reported in the New York Times. It didn't get out of the state. Just the Radar Observer had a memorial from his hometown in Oregon. But anyways, I was able to get all the articles together from the state of Florida, and then I actually spoke to the pilot's brother, and he went into his attic, and he pulled out a shoebox with the original Western Union telegrams from the United States Air Force from the Air Defense Command headquarters, and he gave me copies of all these different telegrams sent to him by General Chidlaw. I put together and combined all the information from what the Air Force had said according to Chidlaw and what was released to the press. Apples and oranges, they didn't make sense. Stanton was able to obtain the aircraft accident reports for me, 68 pages of complete. The book, my book kind of looked like this report, my first book. They were both butchered. This report was butchered, Stanton. And I was able to go through it. It took me a couple of years of going through this report, and I combined the original press release, the brothers' telegrams, and this story, and it was a complete abortion. None of the stories made sense. The Air Force actually had three different times that the jet vanished, all within the same 68-page report. One hand didn't know what the other hand was doing. It was such a massive cover-up. The Air Force did not even contact the next of kin until 3 days later after the event. And in the end, everything was blamed on pilot error.
That's the easy way out, Frank. Of course it's pilot error. What else could have happened? There can't be any alien craft involved, because anything but alien, you know.
Absolutely. So I write about this story very heavily involved in the case. And what was interesting is after Stanton sent me the microfilms for the September 12th, 1952 accident reports, I was flipping through I went over to Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, and they have some nice big new machines there, and I'm flipping through the microfilm reels. And the Jones and Del Curto September 12th case, the pilots that vanished into thin air, okay, right as everything was going on in the Flatwoods area in D.C., these guys had vanished shortly before that. What happened is I'm looking on the microfilm reels, and this case was case number 4. But what happened is I was flipping through the reel, it goes case 1, 2, 4, 6. And I said to myself, something's wrong here. I didn't flip through a whole case file in 1 second. What they had done is the Air Force took the front and back bordering cases to the Jones and Del Curto case and sent them to higher classification, and they're yanked off the microfilm. So we have 2 cases that are gone for September 12th for aircraft accident reports. And that's when I called Stanton up immediately. I said, Stanton, there's cases missing here for September 12th. In the original book, I had talked about this case because at that point there was not one record on the planet Earth of Jones and Del Curto being born, being alive, being in the Air Force. It was not one record, no Social Security death indexes for either one of these airmen. And since the release of that book up till Stanton was able to obtain the accident reports, that report was in there. But we have other ones missing. So there was a lot of crazy stuff going on in that day, and to this day, the airmen have never been found, not one trace. They vanished into thin air, being in a radar net of 3 different major Air Force installations. They just vanished.
I think the point that we're trying to make here is that the government is trying to do anything it can keep this out of public discussion, not to reveal what's going on. It is of the utmost importance to them, apparently, to lie, misrepresent, cover up, whatever word you want to use. They're taking this very seriously. These aren't the only events, of course, like that. But the public needs to be aware that our public servants, which presumably Air Force, Navy people, etc., are involved in a massive cover-up is the only word, the simplest word to use. It's intentional. It's carefully done, obviously under orders. And that's thing, people don't seem to understand that. I mean, let me quote General Carol Bolander, Air Force General. In 1969, or 1968, actually, when he wrote the report, after the Condon report came out early that year, the Air Force asked General Bolander, who had nothing to do with Blue Book, what should we do about Project Blue Book? Because Condon's people had recommended that it be closed because it wasn't doing anything useful, and I agreed with that for that matter. But Bolander was an engineer working on the lunar excursion module, and as people will recall, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the moon in July of 1968. 69, sorry. And so years later, we got a copy of the memo that Bolander wrote. And it was his memo that resulted in the closure of Project Blue Book at the end of 69. In the memo, he says reports of UFOs which could affect national security are made in accordance with JNAP, Joint Army Navy Air Force Publication 146, or Air Force Manual 55-11, and are not part of the Blue Book system. Two paragraphs later, he says, if we close Project Blue Book, the public won't have a place to report UFO sightings. However, as previously noted, reports which could affect national security will continue to be investigated using the procedures designed for that purpose. Now think about that for a minute. Public's always been told, oh, Blue Book was it. That was the only organization that looked at UFOs, and when it was closed, we didn't do anything more. Well, I located General Bolander. He's dead now. But I located him and talked to him, stressed that I'd had a clearance, I understood something about security. I told him, it sounds to me like what you were saying was that there were two separate channels of communication for those reports which could affect national security and those, you know, run-of-the-mill sort of things. And he said, yes. An example I used when I was talking to him was if a saucer goes down the runway at a strategic air command base where nuclear weapons are stored, that's a national security problem. There's not supposed to be any outsider there. If you and I go outside my house here and look up in the sky and see a UFO go over, no big deal. It happens all the time. So people were never told, of course, what Bolander said. But it makes the point that the Air Force has been lying. You write them about UFOs any time since 1969 on. Oh, we closed Project Blue Book. Conclusions was no threat to the security of the United States. No, very carefully worded, I might add. No UFO reported, evaluated, or investigated by the United States Air Force gives any evidence of being a threat to the security of the United States. Now, if any one of those three functions was done by somebody else, could be the Navy, it could be Operation Majestic 12, or anybody else, then it would be a true but totally meaningless statement. They also said no evidence of technology beyond our knowledge. Now, I've worked on fusion propulsion systems for deep space travel. They're not beyond our knowledge. We haven't done it yet, but it's not beyond our knowledge. So they weasel worded, and they've gotten away with it. This is 69 we're talking about, and every year onward, they put out annual reports for quite a few years, and they were lying through their teeth, and no major media group that I'm aware of has ever pointed this out. I've got a copy of Bolander's memo. I mean, this is not an imaginary thing. It's not something somebody read to me over the phone. I have a copy of it. And so, you know, there's a lot more to this story than just what happened in Flatwoods. But it's all part of the same picture of massive misrepresentation and cover-up. I don't care how you slice it. That's what it boils down to. And some people get offended at that. Well, I'm sorry. Governments do cover things up. In my book, Flying Saucers and Science, I have a whole chapter about the cosmic Watergate, and I go through a bunch of big multi-billion dollar programs that were conducted where they were done in secret. Stealth aircraft, we're talking $10 billion over 10 years, Lockheed. $10 billion is a lot of money. The NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office, many people don't even know that it exists, they had a program going at Boeing to change the architecture of the big satellites. Some of their satellites cost $500 million. And they spent $13 billion trying to improve the layout and so forth, and finally had to cancel the program because they didn't get what they wanted. $13 billion in secret. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of cover-up. These are black budget programs. So what we're talking about here are, you know, only the surface, really. There's a lot going on. Some people don't want to admit the government can keep secrets. And, you know, Frank, I've told you the two examples of smart people saying stupid things. Dr. Seth Shostak of the SETI Institute said, governments can't keep secrets. We know that because look how bad a job FEMA did about Katrina. And furthermore, look at how badly they operate the post office. He didn't say anything about DIA, CIA, NRO, NSA, NSC, ONI, all those alphabet soup agencies. There's a real world out there. And Dr. Tyson, head of the Hayden Planetarium, he gave an example. Oh, governments can't keep secrets. We know that's true because look how much we know about President Clinton's genitalia. He said that in a speech to 1,800 people at Penn State University. What in the world has that got to do with keeping secrets about classified matters? Nothing. It got a good laugh from the audience. But I want to be realistic about this, partly because I worked under security for 14 years. And so what we're talking about is just the tip of the iceberg here. And people don't like to think about the fact that we've been hoodwinked, if you will, all these years with the connivance of people like the debunkers who don't think you can keep anything from them. And there are people in Washington who figure, hey, I'm a big shot in Washington. If this were going on, I would know about it, and I don't, so it must not be true. You know, that's nonsense. Is what it boils down to. It's as silly as Phil Klass, the big debunker for many years, several debunking books, senior avionics editor for Aviation Week and Space Technology in Washington, Mr. Go-To by the media because he was in Washington. And not only did he appear on Larry King twice, in each case giving comments about a book and then admitting later on in the show that he hadn't read the book, which is hardly journalistically ethical, but it was like his objection to one of the MJ-12 documents was, oh, it's done in the wrong typeface, it's done on the large Pica type, but I got 9 documents from the National Security Council done in a LEAP type, and I challenge you, Stan, to find any other documents done in the same size and style type, and I'll give you $100 each, up to a maximum of 10, unfortunately. To make a long story short, I was going to the Eisenhower Library. He'd never even been to the Eisenhower Library. He had 9 documents. They got 250,000 pages of National Security Council material. And I immediately sent him, after a visit that I was planning anyway, 14 documents, sent him an invoice for $1,000 because he only would pay for 10. And he paid me. Didn't tell anybody about paying me, but he told a lot of people about challenging me. But this is typical of the kind of nonsense that is put forward to say there's nothing to flying saucers. There's no cover-up. There's nothing going on that we don't know about. There's a great deal going on that we don't know about.
I had a quick question real quick. We have about 15 minutes left in the show, and I was wondering, you said that you go to the National Archives, or where is that at?
Well, I've been to 20 different document archives. The National Archives are branches. So the Presidential Archives are technically branches of the National Archives. But the National Archives is in Washington, D.C., and there's also a National Archives Manuscript Division, which has the papers. It's part of the National Archives. It has the papers of many famous people, and you can spend a lot of time going through them. And then there's the Eisenhower Library in Abilene, Kansas, and the Truman Library in Independence, Missouri, and the Kennedy Library in Boston, and the Reagan Library in California. And there's a bunch more branches of some of these places. Hoboken, New Jersey has a branch of the National Archives, as a matter of fact. In some cases now, they have, not all of them, but most of them have classified documents. So you don't get to grovel around in the library. They give you a finder's aid, and you look through that, and you tell them, I want these boxes. You get archive boxes about 6 inches across and with non-corrosive paper, and all this stuff. And they got all kinds of rules. Anyway, they'll bring you a dozen boxes at a time, and you can only open one box at a time and take out one file folder at a time. And they watch. I've had my wrist slapped for, you've got 2 full file folders open. You can't do that. Whoops, sorry about that. Anyway, you can request, you go through the file folder and you'll find withdrawal sheets. And it'll give you a 2-page memo, John Smith, Paul Jones, this date, top secret. That's about all you know. You can request mandatory classification review of that. You fill out a form. And they submit it to the appropriate people on the other end in Washington, depending on under whose aegis the document was done, you know, in National Security Council, National Security Agency, FBI, DIA, whatever. And if you're lucky, you'll get it. Sometimes my average was running about 2 years to get these mandatory classification reviews. Some take as long as 6 years. So it's not a simple process. And people say, well, why don't you just get the scanned stuff? Well, it isn't scanned, darn it. You got to go there. And I've had people tell me that, well, you know, it's easy. You just, you know, they'll put it on your computer. No, they won't, because it's not scanned. I found out stuff about Dr. Donald Menzel, a debunker who, as it turns out, was up to his ear in classified work. And I had to go to the Harvard archives. I had to get permission from 3 different people to look at his papers, written permission, including his wife. And then you request copies of stuff, and there's no classified stuff in his files. It's been removed. But I couldn't do it from my home. I had to go there. Same with the Forrestal Library. The Forrestal papers are there. So this isn't easy, in other words. One of the archivists at the Eisenhower Library told me that he's had reporters come to him and say, can you put the Majestic 12 in your computer and tell me what you got? No. Why not? Because our stuff isn't computerized. Well, what can I do to find out? Well, you tell me what, you look at our finder's aids, our list of them, and you tell me which ones you want, and we'll bring you the number of boxes, and you go through them one at a time, and we'll see what we can do for you. And they're shocked. They thought it would be, you know, duck soup, real easy. Just everything's on a computer. Well, Eisenhower Library's got 10 or 20 million pages of material, incidentally.
Oh, jeez.
Well, there's one record group at the National Archives that is Air Force Headquarters files from like 48 to 55. It's got 9,800 feet of material. That's shelf space that these boxes take up. That's approximately 1,004 drawer file cabinets. Has anybody looked at all that stuff? Of course not. And you don't get into the archives. They bring to you what you ask for. So when people tell you that this is easy, you know, all you got to do is ask and they'll get you everything you want. Well, it isn't that easy, believe me. My wife will tell you what our expenses were running when I was traveling around all over the place.
On that note, what Stanton's talking about with National Archives, I just want to mention this quick little story. A few years ago, Stanton went in to look for the September 1952 documents of fighter accidents, United States Air Force. And it was interesting that Stanton found the draw, and when he was going through it, the 1 month that was missing was September 1952,
yep.
Within the same time frame that the Flatwoods Monster incident happened with all these crazy things going on with jets. What Stanton did find, and this was a confidential memorandum dated 10 September 52, and what it was a tabulation of major accidents, signed Lieutenant Colonel Myers, and it gives you an idea of what was going on in the summer of 52 with accidents, which at that point, which Stanton mentioned earlier, was the height of the UFO flap. And I'm just going to run through this real quick. These are the documents that Stanton gave me for the United States Air Force June and July 52 fighter accidents. In June of 1952 alone, there were fighter major accidents. There was 100 accidents, 36 aircraft destroyed, and 21 fighter fatalities. In July, we had 135 fighter major accidents, 58 aircraft destroyed. These are all jet fighters, and fighter fatalities was 30. So when you add just those 2 months up, which was at the high point of the summer of the saucer sightings, June and July 52, fighter major accidents totaled 235, 94 aircraft destroyed, and 51 fighter airmen killed just in those 2 months alone. And when I remember asking Stanton what were the stats for September 52 and when he was going through that particular box, the 1 month that was missing was September. That was the main month that I wanted. It wasn't there. So stuff is edited and pulled out and taken away. Maybe they saw you coming, Stanton.
It could be. It's frustrating. It's educational. It's exciting. But this is why I've told people, they say, what's it going to take to break the story open? I say, you need a Woodward and Bernstein, all the president's men, so to speak. But they had the Washington Post behind them. It cost money. And I should add, incidentally, speaking of all the president's men, I have to publicly announce, as I have before, that there are two of my books have been optioned for movies. I'm hoping Frank's will be at some point, too. But one of them is Top Secret Magic, and the movie is Magic Men, M-A-J-I-C. The screenplay's been written and rewritten and rewritten and rewritten. Hopefully the next one will fly. And the other one is Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, by myself and Kathleen Marden, who's Betty's niece and who did most of the work. And this weekend, I'll be at Indian Head Resort in Lincoln, New Hampshire, at an annual conference about the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. And Kathy is speaking.
Oh,
I'm speaking. Yep.
Sorry, Stan, to interrupt you, but we only have a couple minutes left, and at the end of every show, we'd like to have our guests share any links, websites, or
sure.
anything else that they think is pertinent.
That's
Frank,
easy enough. Let's get Frank.
I was going to say, Frank, we also want to ask if you have any book signings coming up for this book that you just released.
Yes, actually I do. I'm going to be in Pennsylvania for the MUFON East Coast Conference on September 28th, Philadelphia. There's information on my website about that. And I'm also going to be in West Virginia for the West Virginia official release of my book at the West Virginia Book Festival. And that's on October 13th and 14th. And my friend Larry Bailey of Brothers Bailey Promotions is going to be putting the show on for me. And we're going to be right in the backyard of Flatwoods.
Give your website, Frank.
It's flatwoodsmonster.com.
Okay, and mine is www.stantonfriedman.com. And my email address, for those who want to pass on the latest secrets, if you will, is FSPHYS, Flying Saucer Physicist, is the easy way to remember that, at Rogers, Rogers.com. Like to hear from you. I don't use names without permission. So if you know something or somebody who might have some information, let me know, and we'll follow up on it.
And especially the fighter pilots or any of the retired airmen who know anything about the Flatwoods case or any involvement within the September 52 era. And we've had a few of them over the years, Stan. Quite a few people have contacted you and I.
Yes. Yeah, people don't know who to talk to, and they're always afraid that they'll be exposed to ridicule or their name will be spread around. And having worked under security for 14 years, I don't spread people's names around. It isn't fair. Nobody else will talk to you if they know you're going to put their name out in public. So we are careful about that. But we know that there's information out there. And if you don't know where to report it to me, FSPHYS at Rogers.com.
Well, again, though, I'd like to thank you guys for the show. I'd say it was probably the best show we've ever done. And I know you guys were saying that you thought it was a good show earlier. Again, though, I'd like to thank you guys for coming on the show. We'll have to do it again probably next year if you guys aren't busy or sometime soon.
Hey, if we're still alive, what do you mean if we're not busy?
And we just touched the tip of the iceberg tonight, Stanton, with 2 hours. We could probably go on for a couple years, right?
Well, months anyway. Thanks for having us on. We really appreciate the opportunity to spread the word.
And thanks again. And if, again, everybody, go to StantonFriedman.com to see what Stanton's up to or to talk to him. Or you can go to FlatwoodsMonster.com to get a hold of Frank. And there's links to get his new revised edition of his Braxton County Monster book. And again, thanks, guys, for going on the show, and we'll have to do it again soon.
Thanks much.
Thank you.
Good night.
Again, guys.
Have a good night.
Have a good night, both of you guys.